Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm so pleased to have with me today Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
Many people might recognize the name, but how would you introduce Murray Sinclair to someone?
Well, to call Murray Sinclair a trailblazer would be to not be doing a service to Murray. Everywhere Murray went, he was, it's been said before, he was the first to do things everywhere he went. He was the first Indigenous judge in Manitoba, only the second Indigenous judge in all of Canada. He trailblazed everywhere. He was a scholar, an athlete, someone that it's impossible to define. And the significance of what Murray has done for First Nations, Métis, and really all people in Canada is just, we can't underestimate and understate how much he contributed to Canada and its well-being.
Can you tell us about his life? Maybe start with his childhood.
Well, I know that he was raised by his mother, and he eventually was raised by his grandparents. So he was someone that maybe didn't come from like a very steady home, but when his grandparents took him over, I understand that things went pretty good for him. But he had a similar perhaps upbringing to a lot of the First Nations in Canada, where we weren't raised necessarily in a like traditional nuclear style family that people of European descent are more used to. Indigenous people, we really are like an extended family. Our aunts and uncles, grandparents, sisters, cousins, they all take a role in raising of family members. So I think Murray's sort of fits in that category as well.
Now, I understand growing up, he was quite a good student.
Yes, apparently he was the valedictorian at his school, which, I know you don't get to that point if you're not academically strength-based, but also you need to be socially strength-based to win valedictorian. So it looks like he just got accolades from all around. And again, like he was always reminding people that he was the athlete of the year as well, too, at his school.
Do we know why he wanted to become a lawyer?
Well, that's a good question. I think that originally he was not going to school to be a lawyer, but it ended up happening that way, where he became an executive assistant to someone in politics that I think that probably opened his eyes to the bigger picture of what was happening in Canada. And I think that Murray's mind being the way it was, he probably thought that he could best serve in that capacity as a lawyer. He was able to see where there were injustices in the system, and he probably wanted to fight those injustices, because we know he did, and he fought many injustices in his day.
You've already alluded to something that I wanted to explore with you, and that was, what kind of a lawyer was he? What kind of cases did he take on?
Well, he was specializing in Indigenous I think a lot of areas that are Indigenous related. So he wasn't in, say, family law or wills and estates. He was in the areas of law that could specifically help Indigenous folks in Canada.
Now, he was called to the bar in 1980, and then a mere 8 years later, he became an associate chief judge. What does that tell us about his abilities?
Well, it means that he would have impressed a lot of people along the way. And so to be from 8 years to being called to the bar to becoming the second Indigenous judge in Canada, that's a miracle. It's incredible. And people, he did have some naysayers at the time. He tells a story of how when he was first like in the cafeteria hanging out with all the other judges, and one judge said to him, he's like, "You know, you're only here because you're Indigenous, right? And we all feel sorry for you." And then Murray's response was, "You know, you're only here because you're white." So that's the kind of man that Murray was.
Murray Sinclair was a lifelong advocate for Indigenous rights. He was part of a commission that identified the disproportionate number of Indigenous people who ended up in the criminal justice system. What impact did this have on Indigenous people?
I think you're referring to the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry in Manitoba, which was a landmark inquiry at the time, and the repercussions from that inquiry were nationwide. So he had brought to the forefront how Indigenous people were discriminated against at every single level of the judicial process, from being stopped by police officers when, you know, if you weren't Indigenous, the police officer might have let you go or let you off without a warning or with a warning, and then just getting into you know, when you're triaged at the station, getting the charges laid, and then you know, getting the maximum sentences. So every step along the way in that justice system, it was determined that Indigenous people were discriminated against. So people went from you know, maybe a very minor offense to spending 20 years in jail just because of that discrimination level. So whereas like non-Indigenous people might not have even entered into the justice system for whatever infraction it was, Indigenous people were compounded with discrimination to the fullest extent of the law, to the point where 40% of all inmates in Canada were Indigenous.
It wasn't just his work as a lawyer and as a judge and as a commissioner that he distinguished himself. He did a lot of other things as well.
Oh, absolutely. So even before he was in part of the TRC, he took on discrimination in the Thunder Bay policing. That might have actually been after TRC. I can't remember the exact dates, but he took a critical role in identifying the discrimination that was happening at the Thunder Bay policing, and I think we've all heard about it in the news what happened there. So, these are the kinds of things that he not did on the side, but just things that he was always doing. He was the chancellor at Queen's University, and he was also an air cadet, and he always supported the cadets. So, like, he had a lot of interests. So it's really hard to pigeonhole him and say, "Oh, this is how you can define Murray." You just can't define him because he did so many different things.
In 2009, Murray Sinclair was appointed Chief Commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Why do you think he was a good person to lead this commission?
Well, I think it's because of his knowledge, understanding, his capacity to be fair, the honor and respect that Indigenous people in Canada had from at the time. And he was originally asked to be the commissioner when the TRC was founding, and he actually turned it down. And Justice Laforme had taken it over. So at that time, there were some problems with the TRC, and all of the commissioners resigned, and they reformed with a new commission. And at that time, Murray Sinclair accepted the role of chief commissioner. So that's when he came in, and I think that you know, the rest is history. But his understanding of the law, his ability to reach out to people, and we know that he listened to 6,000 survivors' stories during his years at the TRC.
The changes that he made when he came in and almost had to restart the process. Could you describe for us the impact that this had on the commission and its work?
Well, I think the TRC wasn't well defined in the first days. A lot of people were thinking, is this another Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, which we know was a very important seminal commission that happened in Canada. It was the longest and most expensive commission, but it also, in my mind, was the most accomplished and accepted one. So when you were looking at the TRC, they wanted to make sure they got it right, but they were also thinking, we don't want it to last forever. But you can't put a timeline on a TRC like that. So I think in the early days, the TRC was kind of waffling and wasn't sure of their mandate and how they're going to move forward. And then when Murray came in, he gave that credibility to the commission. He didn't pull any punches. He's like, this is going to take a long time. We're going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to collect all of our evidence, and we're not going to take shortcuts or rush anything where we don't need to. So he brought that formalization and integrity to the commission.
You mentioned the number of people who gave depositions at the commission. And I know that you've personally experienced listening to people tell their stories of residential schools and other harms that happened to Indigenous people. How is it that he could possibly listen to that much, and how must it impacted him? Can you give us some insight?
Well, he originally turned down the role of chief commissioner for that exact reason, where he thought it was going to be too hard, unbearable to hear all those stories. But when you're in this line of work, you realize it has to be done and someone has to do it. And are you the right person to do it? If you don't think you are, then you're not. You have to be prepared for this. You have to know that it's going to be an unlimited well of sorrow that you're going to have to go through and listen to. But know that every single person's story is important and you can't be tired and say, oh, it's the end of the day. Let's wrap this up. You have to give your utmost respect and time to every single survivor who has their story to tell.
You worked with the commission. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
No, it's funny how in a lot of different areas we were tied together. We worked in a lot of the same areas, including working on Queen's University advisory on Indigenous issues up until just earlier this year. But it's crazy. We never actually met in person, even though we had so much in common over the last 2 decades, 2.5 decades.
Well, it sounds like you were in the same room. What was your impressions of him when you saw him?
He was very confident but open, and he actually reminds me a lot of my father because they even look a lot alike. They have similarities in their style and how they move. So I instantly had a great affinity for him, and I just I maybe I projected a lot of positivity and on him, but of course it was all well deserved. So I immediately liked him, and I'm pretty sure everyone who ever met him immediately liked him as well too.
Education was a cornerstone of his approach to advancing Indigenous rights. I mean, you look and you see that he often spoke about the path forward being centered on teaching, whether it was children at school or adults or the role of media to educate people about Indigenous issues and history. Can you elaborate on this significance of education as a theme?
Well, I think Murray must have recognized that it's very difficult to change people's minds once they have developed their ideas in life. And the way to address this is through the education system. So people, students, learners sitting in their classrooms ready with an open mind to learn something. I think Murray Sinclair recognized that that's the best time to reach people. So we might not convince people that aren't in the education system about new ways of thinking, but this is the time to get them. And these generational changes and understanding of the issues is the approach that he took. So this is why reconciliation is a long-term process. You have some people that will never change their opinion about Indigenous people. Some might hold racist views that you're never going to get them to shake. So we need to basically focus on the next generation or anyone with an open mind who wants to learn these issues. And I should also note that Murray Sinclair had 20 honorary degrees from universities. This is how much he was respected by the educational institutions of this country and beyond.
How is Sinclair viewed within the Indigenous community?
I would say since the late 80s, if you were paying attention to what was going on in the indigenous world, you would have known his name. He would have come up. There were a lot of big movers and shakers in the 80s and 90s. So he was definitely among those names that people that were making a really good change for indigenous people in Canada. But of course, his legend just kept on growing. He didn't stop. So he went from like someone who was a mover and a shaker in the 80s and 90s to the level that he eventually achieved to the point where he really doesn't have any peers in the world of Indigenous people in Canada because his accomplishments are just so great.
What is something you think non-Indigenous Canadians should know about him that they may not already know?
Well, he didn't fight just for First Nations. He was fighting for Canada. He was fighting for a fair and just Canada where discrimination against Indigenous people is bad, but discrimination against anyone is bad. He wanted a Canada where people would be treated fairly based on the merits of who they are, and not to discriminate against people just because of maybe their socioeconomic standing or the color of their skin or their gender. So he really was the epitome of someone who represented and fought for a fair and just nation.
What will be his lasting impact on you?
Well, I really wish that we had sat down for a coffee and just chatted a bit. I would have learned so much from him. He probably wouldn't have learned as much from me, but I would have learned a lot from him. So again, that would have been a selfish thing to want to take up his time for that, but he sets the bar high. So if you want to know what it takes to accomplish great things, I think use Murray Sinclair as an example, how he was someone that was beyond reproach. I'm sure he had his detractors, but I don't even know any. Everyone just seems to universally adore him. You wouldn't be able to detract from him because he was such a man of high standing and honor that any attacks against his character would fall flat.
What do you think his lasting impact will be on Alderville?
Well, I think that he gives a role model to our youth. He's someone that everyone around here was really sad and upset when he passed. We knew he was in ill health, but of course, he never really think it's going to happen. He was fairly young. 73 years old is young these days. So I think it was a big shock. We weren't ready. If you know. I think it's something that we would have loved to have honored him if we knew that we had limited time with him. We would have definitely invited him to the community, rolled out the red carpet, have him speak, give him gifts and honors. You never know how long you're going to be on this planet for. So I think all of Alderville's behind him, all First Nations in Canada are behind him, and it was just a really sad moment when we heard of his passing.
Thank you for talking to me today about Murray Sinclair.
Thank you.
Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the Chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. The First Nations chiefs from across Canada voted not to accept a $47 billion settlement agreement on long-term reform of First Nations child and family services. You attended this meeting. Can you describe what happened?
Well, I think the division was clear from the beginning. You had in a lot of ways, two schools of thought. One was that the agreement didn't go far enough. It only was for 10 years. And then we might have to talk about a new way of doing things after those 10 years. We had a lot of the child and family services agencies that were Indigenous specific that had a number of issues with them. You had remote communities that wanted to ensure that their, I guess, Budgets were taking into account that everything cost more, but then you had basically non isolated communities that are effectively isolated. Like when you look at some of the communities that are on islands, even though they might be in proximity close to, say, a major city like Toronto, to get to an island to bring in resources and pretty much everything that has to come in on a barge, you are in effect an isolated community, and these kind of things weren't taken into account in that settlement. So I think there were enough holes that you had a large group, and in the end, it turned out to be a majority that thought that the agreement was just too fraught to be able to pass. So when the time came for a vote, no one in the room was surprised because of the questions that were being asked and the talk and the chatter that was happening around. So even though Ontario was majority in support of this agreement, Canada, First Nations as a whole, eventually opposed it, and it really wasn't even close.
Well, can we just talk a little bit more about those who are for the agreement? Can you elaborate upon what it was that they saw that made this a good agreement in the first place?
Well, that's the school of that I fell into. So I felt that the dollar figure was adequate. I don't think that we needed to hold out for more. I know that the political landscape is vastly changing. So I thought, stone in hand is worth two in the bush, basically. So I thought, we might not see this deal again. So I, even though there were problems with the agreement, I, as a chief of my First Nation, and knowing the problems that we have with our child welfare work, I knew that we needed to help these people now. It's fine if, 5 years from now we get the perfect agreement, but what happens in those 5 years? So I wanted action for right now, for tomorrow. And those were my motivations.
You alluded to it a couple of times while you were talking, but you weren't specific. You said that there could be changes. What are those changes that you're so worried about that could have a negative impact?
Well, it's kind of the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. So we were dealing with the federal government on this agreement, and so if there is a change at the federal level, it would be a different negotiating team. There might be different agendas. They might decide that they want to make an example or something. So you really don't know how the negotiations would go under a different government. So not wanting to take that chance, I felt it was in our best interest to accept the deal as it was. And, in 10 years, when there's going to be maybe some renegotiation, we'd be in a better position. But the majority of the chiefs in Canada didn't see it that way, and they feel that they will get a better deal in the next round of negotiations.
What are residents saying to you? How did they respond to the news when it came out? And what did they say to you about your position?
I think there was general shock because in Ontario, we had just had a Chiefs of Ontario meeting, and we even voted on it. There was only like six First Nations in all of Ontario that did vote against the agreement. So we were pretty confident. Everyone in Ontario was confident. We had gotten specific Ontario concessions. So I think if you weren't in the room for those couple of days, I think they were in shock. Like, how could the Chiefs have turned down this agreement? I think there was a lot of finger pointing and just jaws dropping. Like, how is that even possible? So it's something that we had to explain to the community of why this happened. And it looks like Ontario is actually going to try to maybe don't quote me on this because it might not happen, but we might try to get something just for Ontario.
What should people be looking for in the near future as this unfolds?
Well, I think if we are going back to the drawing board, that would hopefully mean they are looking for more input, more voices from First Nations communities. And if that's the case, I would urge everyone who's affected or has an opinion on the issue to pull up and go to these tables and say how this new agreement can best represent you. So if the problem was is that First Nations and people weren't included enough and get their voices heard enough, then this new approach by logic should be trying to engage with the First Nations, the communities, and the leadership. So this is what I'm looking forward to, and I'm optimistic that we will get a better agreement in place because of this new process that might be going out. So right now, everything's on the table. People are scrambling. It's still fresh. People are not sure what's going to happen next. So we need to be prepared for any and all scenarios. But I think the most important thing is to get out there and have your voice heard.
Thank you for talking to me about this. What's going on in Alderville that we should be keeping an eye on?
Okay, well, that's a very good question. We have lots going on the go. It's we're getting in close to Christmas, so we have a lot of those events coming up. But on November 23rd, we're having our annual health fair in the community center. We're having that from 10 to 3. So this year's theme is holistic health. So we're going to have a number of booths set up. And if you're interested in health and health issues, and I hope everyone is, come on down on November 23rd. Let's see. So we have a Alderville Williams Treaty Settlement Trust annual engagement meeting, and it includes a dinner on December 12th. And that's from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Alderville Community Center. So this is open to all members of Alderville First Nation, and you can also join with the Zoom. So we want all members, no matter where you are in Canada, to attend this meeting and have your voice said on the direction that you want the trust to be taking in the future. On December 16th at 10 a.m., we have a play and learn session. So we're having brunch with Santa for all the little ones, and that's going to be at the ACC. You have to sign up by December 9th. So please call our Health and Social Services building and let them know that you want to bring your little tyke to the play and learn. So there's a couple of other notes. On every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m., we have our men's drum night. So all Alderville men and boys, if you're interested in learning to drum, no matter if you're just starting or if you're a pro, we want you to be there. That's going to be at the Hilltop. So I'd also like to state that we had another successful racing season. We actually had the busiest racing season in a long time. Our race beds across the various lakes, Rice Lake, Chemung Lake, Pigeon Lake, were bigger than ever. And our race bed in Rice Lake is actually bigger than it's been in nearly 100 years. So race is coming back to Rice Lake. I'd like to remind people that the food bank is open and available to all residents of Alderville, whether you're a member of Alderville or not. If you live in Alderville, you can access the food bank. But please call ahead to make an appointment. And just on a couple of hiring notes, we're looking to hire an archaeological program coordinator. So if that's something that you have a passion for archaeology and you got some experience, we'd love to hear from you. We're also looking to hire a community health representative. So if you're in the area of community health and you want to work with our First Nation, please contact Melissa Levesque and hand in your CV. And of course, one last thing, winter's coming. We are looking to hire snow shovelers for the winter. So if you're a young or you don't have to be young, as long as you're able to come out and shovel snow for our elders when the snow falls, and then please contact the band office and we'll set you up. And that's all of our announcements for this month.
Dinner Simpson, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you. And of course, it's always a pleasure to be here.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.